Thank you, Paddy. Well, it's lovely to see you all. I hope you're all feeling very well fed. What I hope that doesn't mean is that you're all going to fall asleep. I'm sure you won't, because we've got... Well, I don't really need to introduce Vidanya, do I? But I'm going to introduce him, of course. So tonight we have Desert Island Retreat for Vidanya. This is our last one of the series, and we're going out with a bang, I hope. Not too much of a bang. So Vidanya has been an absolute keystone of the Sheffield Sangha for many, many years. And in fact, without Vidanya, there may not be a Sheffield Sangha as it exists at this point now. I'm just wondering who's coming in the door. I don't think anyone is. So Vidanya's been a real key player at the Buddhist Centre, teaching the Dharma week in, week out. He wrote the enormously successful Beginner's Course, which has been adopted by other centres across the UK. And he's particularly well known for his very eloquent way of teaching the Dharma, making it accessible and understandable and relatable to our lives in the 21st century. I was talking to a friend yesterday about this interview, and she said, well, when I first came along, it was I just felt like I really got the Dharma. And it was because of the way it was taught in the Beginner's Course. It was so understandable and relatable. But she also said, and I also felt really at home in the Buddhist Centre. And I think lots of people come along and say, I just felt like I arrived home. I think that's got a lot to do with Vidanya's particular take on how we develop Sangha in Sheffield. And we're going to talk a bit more about that over the next hour or so. So, yes.
Okay.
I have to say, I'm a little bit nervous tonight. you probably realised. Anyway, yes. I'll just put that aside. So let's start, Vidanya.
Okay.
I'm off.
So we said might well, go out with a bang. So my first track is an excerpt from Tub Thumping by Chawumba Wamba. Shorn of the swearing and the alcohol references, the main lyric is, I get knocked down, but I get up again. You ain't never going to keep me down. And I chose that because when I was 3 3/4, I was indeed knocked down and indeed run over by a lorry. And I was very, very badly injured. I wasn't really expected to survive. But I got up again. So I get knocked down, but I get up again.
Thank you, Paddy.
Thank you very much, Paddy. That's very precise.
The timings are kind of important on that track, yeah.
So, yeah, so I got knocked down, 3 3/4, run over, very badly injured. So that's obviously had a huge impact on my life. I spent the next 18 months in hospital solid. I think I was quite lucky that I think there were still surgeons around and facilities around left over from putting men back together after the Second World War. It's a specialist plastic surgery hospital, quite a long way from where my parents lived. So it's a very lonely experience. Actually, my memory of it is of a pretty hellish experience, really. Of being, yeah, sort of lonely hell, with occasionally punctuated by being taken out and tortured, is how I remember it. But there was one bright spot in this, which was that I've got this really vivid memory in my mind that for quite a long time I was in a bed that looked out a window onto some Scots pines. And these Scots pines would move gently in the wind. And with nothing else to do for months on end, I just would watch these Scots pines. And I would go into a Dharanic trance, watching these Scots pines, and just loved it. And I suppose this has started a love affair with the elements and with the natural world. I just love the natural world. And I've always loved just mindful awareness of the natural world and allowed that to sort of take me somewhere else. And that's obviously fed into my meditation. So, when I first came across meditation, I just loved it. And I think it connected back to that. Mm. So that, you know, that was the positive that came out of it. Mm. So I spent 18 months solid in hospital and 18 months in hospital most of the time, but not always. And I was seven. I wasn't seven till I went to school. I couldn't read. I couldn't write. They didn't taught me anything in hospital. I couldn't read, couldn't write. Clearly couldn't play football, couldn't be like the other kids. And I felt like an alien. And I think this has started also a long career of feeling like an alien. Like, this is not my true home. I've got a true home somewhere, which is somewhere else, and a longing for that, which I think has also fed into my Dharma practice. I was a bright kid, so I ended up in the top stream quite quickly, despite not being able to read or write. When I was 10, just to add to the sense of being an alien, my father got a job in Argentina, and we moved to Argentina. So this was a terrific adventure. This was a terrific adventure. We went by boat. My father's a bit of an adventurer. We went by boat, not a cruise liner, a smallish boat that carried beef one way and lorries the other, and a few passengers. We stopped at Lisbon, Las Palmas, Recife in Brazil, Santos in Brazil, Montevideo, and then Buenos Aires. And I saw flying fish, I saw dolphins riding alongside the boat. I'd never seen colors like it, I'd never seen blue like it. We got to Lisbon, it's like, I couldn't believe it. Mm-hmm. So it was a terrific adventure going. And then we had some terrific adventures there, including going with my dad taking us on a road trip 3 days across dirt roads, across the completely unpopulated Patagonia to get to the Andes. And there seemed to be, the Andes were just astonishing. I saw glaciers and turquoise lakes full of trout. I loved fishing. I'm sorry, I loved fishing until I was, until I found Buddhism. It seemed to be only populated by Germans who'd gone over after the war of a slightly sort of dubious political persuasion, I thought. It's quite probable. Argentina. And then from Argentina, one thing about Argentina was good for me because I came into my strength, a very outdoor life, swimming, etc., etc. So it came into some strength rather than just being a bit of a weed, really. Then we moved to Detroit.
So you were following your dad's job?
I was following my dad's job, yeah. We moved to Detroit. But I haven't got any music from either Argentina or Detroit because I'm not allowed enough. Surely I should have some Tamla Motown. But Yeah, we moved to Detroit. It seemed to be snow on the ground all the time, as far as I can remember. Not quite. And yeah, my first really awareness of music, and my first crush, my first date, et cetera, 13 years old. And then we moved to Mexico. I loved Mexico. I just loved Mexico. So I had to have some Mexican music. I wanted to get some Mexican music that just communicated something of the sort of slightly off the wall, anarchic joie de vivre, alegría of Mexico, which sort of balances the dark side that's definitely there. And this track is a bit arbitrary, actually, because I didn't listen to Mexican music while I was there. I listened to rock, you know. I mean, the Stones, the Grateful Dead, you know. That was the... So it's slightly arbitrary, because I'm not really aware of Mexican music, but I thought it's jolly. And Mexico's got this jolliness to it. And although there's a sort of saludo a Colombia in the beginning, it's definitely about Mexico. The woman who's singing says that she's from the southern state of Oaxaca. And those pre-Columbian names, they still resonate with me. They still sort of carry real sort of resonance for me. I'll say a bit more about that later. But my next track is La Campanera by Lila Downs.
En el baile todos se alborotan con mi ritmo alegre.
So that that expresses your love of Mexico.
Well, a bit more than a bit more about it than that, really. Mm. I mean, Mexico, especially, it's not like the cowboy movies. Most of it is very, very different from that. It's a hugely beautiful, varied, very, very atmospheric country with everything from tropical rainforest to subtropical, lush subtropical forest to alpine forest to tundra to snow-capped mountains. We could see two snow-capped volcanoes from our house. The genii loci, if that's the right grammatical term in Latin, the spirits of place are extremely strong. They've got a very strong presence. My father, who wasn't the most sensitive of people, used to say, Mexico's got an atmosphere you could cut with a knife. So I went to the American high school in Mexico, aptly named the Country Club. And it was the first time in my life I'd really made close friends. So I traveled quite widely in Mexico, initially with my family. My father loved traveling around and encouraged me to do so. And so later with friends, group of friends, we thought it was safe if there were six of us. Not the safest of countries, especially for a gringo. And you try telling them, I'm not a gringo, I'm English. That doesn't work. Anyway, a lovely country and very warm people as well. Mm-hmm. So I traveled quite widely. And one particular sort of memorable thing was that one summer, six of us went down to help an agronomist to terrace fields on a steep hillside in mountain rainforest, basically, with a tribe that people, the Tzeltals, who were descendants of the Mayans. And this was seriously remote. You had to fly into a really scary little airfield in a little plane, walk a long way to the village. They called us Mexicans because, as far as they were concerned, everybody from outside their village was Mexican. And they didn't speak Spanish. They spoke Tzeltal. Mm. And we stayed with this guy, Jarvis, maybe I shouldn't mention names, who was an agronomist but also a really heavy-duty evangelical Christian. I don't think he particularly wanted us there, but this had been arranged by a teacher at the school, Quaker teacher, who thought we needed saving. Six, because we were the clever bad boys. We were the clever bad boys. And Mexico at that time was a very exciting place to be. I mean, it was full of late 60s, full of American draft dodgers who we used to mix with.
You were influenced by Aldous Huxley?
So all my friends, we'd all read The Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley, okay? About how if the doors of perception are cleansed, all things would appear as they are, infinite, which is a quote from William Blake. And our badness consisted of being slightly too enthusiastic about trying to cleanse our doors of perception using the very many botanical means of doing so that exist in Mexico. We really thought we were trying to get higher mental states, actually. And I suppose, you know, right through my teens, I did see life as a sort of spiritual quest. At one point, I longed to be a Christian. I just couldn't believe it. But so there was definitely that sort of dimension to it. Mm.
You left Mexico, though, at 19, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. So, I fell out with my father.
Fell out with your
dad. I fell out with my father. It usually takes two to tango. I seriously fell out with my father. It takes two to tango. My father was in some ways quite a difficult man to have a teenage, to be a teenage son of. Mm. You either were like him or you weren't, right, basically. Mm. He was a difficult man, and I was a pretty horrible teenager, really. I was quite arrogant, I think, and very dismissive of the values of the previous generation. I don't think there had ever been a bigger generation gap. than between the people who'd lived through the Depression and the Second World War and the kids growing up in the 60s. Yeah. It was just huge. Just a completely different way of looking at life. So I fell out with my dad and moved to London. And I couldn't believe London. I'd lived in Latin America. I just had this really clear image of all these people sort of like, I saw them as like they're in mazes and they've all got blinkers on so they don't see each other. And they're all running through these intersecting mazes without taking any notice of each other, all on some sort of agenda that you can't fathom. They're just all running. And nobody looked at you. No. I mean, Latin America's not like that. I couldn't believe London. It was just weird. I moved into a bedsit in North London. And that's what this next track is about, which is The City Never Sleeps by Eurythmics. Mm.
Should we have that track, Paddy? Great.
I guess it's just a feeling.
So in my tiny little bedsit, I think I really could hear the sound of the underground trains. And there were so many people living in this house. I didn't know their names. They didn't look at you. Didn't pay any attention to anybody else. Pretty horrendous start, actually. I thought London was going to be this wonderful scene.
It was the swinging 60s, wasn't
it? It was the swinging 60s. It wasn't particularly swinging there at first. But I did make some friends and moved into what you can only describe as a hippie house, which consisted of predominantly partying all the time, until we were thrown out. I mean, literally thrown out. Me and another guy were literally thrown out by the landlord, who happened to be an all-in wrestler, a professional wrestler. And he threw us down the stairs, and we went and complained at the local police station, but they weren't having any of it. And so I ended up homeless in London. I was homeless in London. And I wasn't very... I was a rich kid, really, from a fairly privileged background. Mm. And I didn't have a national insurance number. I didn't know anything about benefits. And I ended up homeless on the streets of London.
What did you do?
Well, I slept sometimes on park benches. Really good thing was to get on the Circle Line, and if you could avoid the conductors, you could sleep going around the Circle Line. It was warm. It was winter. It was winter in London. I'd never been that cold before either. So sleep on the Circle Line. I got the flu, and I just descended on some people I knew very vaguely and said, "I've got the flu. I need somewhere to sleep," and they let me sleep it off. So I wasn't enamoured of London.
Not surprisingly.
I got very sick of London and hitched down to the southwest, actually. Mm. Hitched down to the southwest. And initially just finding wherever I could to sleep. And then got work in the tourist industry. There was a bit of an alternative scene down in the various sort of touristy places in the southwest. Worked in tourist-related things in the summer and in anything you could find in the winter.
And this was, what period of time was it?
So this was
early 70s?
This was early 70s, so yeah, sort of 70, 71, 72, yeah. 73 yeah. That time.
So you were kind of 19, 20?
I was 21. 19 when I went to when I went to London. I was probably getting on 20 by the time I ended up in the southwest. I spent the best part of a year, I suppose, in London.
And completely cut off from your family, or just
I cut myself off. Yeah. I didn't know my family. I got extended family in the UK, but I didn't know them. Mm. I've been abroad all this time, basically. Mm. And I think poor old mum. It was very unfair because I think she was very worried about me. But did eventually sort of get in touch. Mm. But anyway, I really loved the Southwest. Elements again. I got a sailboat, bought myself a sailing boat. That's a wonderful experience of the elements. You got the through the water and the power of the wind. Loved the sea. Did that for a bit. And then went to join a commune, which was the sort of thing we had in those days, a commune, where we used to make leather goods to sell to the hippie clothing trade in London. So this commune was started by a couple called Jackie and Michael. Michael was gay and Jackie was a lesbian, so their relationship slightly puzzled me. But Michael was a very skilled leather worker, and Jackie had got loads of contacts in the hippie shops and clothing trade in London. So Michael used to do very highly skilled stuff on boots and bags, but most of us were just making these big, really thick leather belts that were very trendy at the time. We tooled them and dyed them. And so we would sort of be a bit hedonistic lifestyle for about 2 weeks. And then Jackie would say, "We've got an order to fill. We've got an order to fill." And we worked like billio all the last night, load it into the Morris Traveller. Jackie would go off to London. She'd come back with a check, and it would all start again. Let's go out and buy some. Yeah, anyway. But that ended because the lease ran out on the farmhouse that we rented, and they moved to Brighton, and Brighton was altogether too urban for me, basically. So yeah. I didn't go with them.
You were too busy enjoying the elements in the southwest. I was just going to say this.
That brings me to my next track. Yeah. So my next track relates to that, relates to making leather goods in a commune, but also to various things.
Well, I was going to say it seems very apt for what came later as well.
Yeah, very apt for what came later. It's sort of recurrent theme, but I wanted something that sort of expressed some of the altruism of the times, because although there was an awful lot of nonsense, there was also a lot of altruism actually. And I've chosen this track partly because I knew someone who knew the drummer in the band, and I'd heard them play in Mexico. Anyway, it's Let's Work Together by Canned Heat.
Next.
Okay, so, well, as I said, the people moved to Brighton and I didn't want to go there.
To Wales, I think, didn't you?
Well, and yeah, so, well, what happened is eventually I got tired of being a hippie, basically, and decided to go to university. Yeah. So I went to Bangor in North Wales to study agricultural botany, the science of growing plants, if you like. I suppose there's a couple of the most impressive people I'd met in my life had been working in that field. Anyway, so I moved to North Wales, and what happened when I was there? Yeah, got married.
Got married, yeah.
Spent most of our time there living on Anglesey in a place called Newborough, extreme southwest of Anglesey, where we renovated a house, basically. I had a boat, which I kept on Llantwyn Island, which Amoghavaksha has inhabited Lantuan Island as well. Very, very beautiful place, nature reserve. I fished, grew veg. We had a freezer full of food. We were nearly self-sufficient. That was very cool at the time, back to nature. That was really cool. Might not be now. But also, of course, this experience of the elements. I just remember it as being very, very beautiful. This incredible beach. You could see the Klin Peninsula, Snowdonia across the way. Used to spend quite a lot of time down there. Maybe I'd go fishing and then bring some fish back. We'd have a barbecue on the beach. It was just lovely. I loved North Wales.
That's great.
And then left North Wales. I'm sorry, I'm having to... loads of years, many years between tracks because I'm so old. I'm sorry. I got a well-paid job in Doncaster, working for British Coal, using some of the statistical techniques and computer modelling techniques that I'd been using in my PhD studies. And I worked for an organisation. I worked for doing what's called operational research. Vimla Das is the only person I know who doesn't do it, who knows what that is. But, basically, it's applying those sorts of mathematical or computing techniques to management problems. Yeah. And it was a great place to work. My first boss is now an order member, Shantipala.
I think he came to the Dharma through you,
he did come to the Dharma through me, yeah. Maybe I'll go to the... Yeah. So basically, it was more like working in a university than it was like... Everybody there had got a postgraduate degree. Mm. It's more like working in a university than working for British Coal. We sat pretty ill in British Coal, actually. So it's a great place to work. I was well paid. I got promoted. I seemed to do very well at it, not because I was particularly good at it, but because I was good at talking to the senior managers, I think. Had a nice house with a quarter of an acre garden in a conservation village in North Notts. Everything's wonderful. My life is wonderful. I used to sometimes think, though, is this it? And then my health broke down. Some of the internal plastic surgery that had been done on me when I was young started to fail. Pain, I could palpable lumps. GP said she thought it was probably cancer, which wasn't a very wise thing to say. I got depressed. I took one antidepressant and decided I didn't like the feeling of it. Anyway, it wasn't cancer, but I had to have a major operation. My wife left me. And I just, having faced death, I just thought, I'm living the wrong life. I'm living the wrong life. So I moved to Sheffield, out of middle of nowhere, really. I moved to Sheffield because I got friends here. I must admit, I had a bit of a second teenage period in Sheffield. I love dancing. Lots of good friends that I still have.
And you were still working for British Coal?
I was still working for British Coal. I just wanted to get out. I wanted to get out, but also it's the period when British Coal is really winding down. We're having the miners' strike, McGregor. But I wanted to get out anyway. I just wanted to do something different. I had this strong feeling I was living somebody else's life.
So there was a sort of, is this it question?
Well, the is this it question even occurred when I had, like, it was all right. But having looked death, I just thought, well, what am I doing?
Yeah.
What am I doing? This is the wrong life. This is the wrong life. And I wanted to get out. I had all sorts of plans. I tried to interest some people in buying a sheep farm in Chile, but that was... I started crewing on...
You were going to crew in the Caribbean?
I crewed on seagoing boats. And I was studying navigation and whatnot. Yeah. I wanted to buy a boat and sail off to the West Indies and ferry around rich Americans or something like that.
So lots of sort of searching for
I was definitely searching for some different sort of lifestyle.
So where did you find it?
Well, okay, so yeah, it went on for a couple of years, this, to the point that somebody I worked with bought me Waiting for Godot for my birthday. And I said, why have you bought me Waiting for Godot? And he said, because waiting for you to leave is like waiting for Godot. Anyway, I was looking in the personal columns of The Guardian, and I was almost certainly looking for a date. And I saw an advert. Unprecedented, an advert for a Buddhist retreat at Padmaloka. And, well, I first came across Buddhism when I was a teenager, and I remember reading... Buddhism holds that all our suffering is due to selfish craving, and I thought, well, it's clearly true. And I felt like I'd got a connection with meditation, as I've sort of described, and mindfulness. So I thought, oh, I'll go. I don't know that they ever, before or after, advertised basically a Padmaloka retreat in The Guardian. It wasn't just a weekend, it was a retreat. There were, I think, three of us went who'd never come across Sri Ratna before. There was me, there was a Church of England vicar, and a prison officer who, rather ironically, went over the wall after the second day. Did a runner. But I really took to meditation. Tejananda taught me meditation, I remember that. And I just thought, wow, this is it. I just had that thing about coming home. I thought, this is where I belong. Mm. This is where I belong. This is my people. Mm. Despite there being quite a lot, to be honest, quite a lot wrong, I think, with Sri Ratna, with FWBO in those days. So this brings me to my next track, which is Anthem by Leonard Cohen. Not yet. So the line I really like about, well, maybe I should just play it. One of the lines I really like is, there is a crack in everything. That's where the light shines in, or where the light gets in. And it felt like, yeah, somehow the light had shone in somehow. And so it describes samsara, pretty horrendous samsara and sort of imperfection, but... ring the bells that still can ring. And I'll say a bit more about that afterwards. But yeah, so it's Anthem by Leonard Cohen.
Thank you, Paddy.
The birds, they sing at the break of day. Start again, I heard them say. Don't dwell on what has passed away or what is yet to be. Yeah, the war, they will be fought again. The holy dove, she will be cut again. Bought and sold and bought again. The dove is never free. Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. For signs, the signs were sent. The birth betrayed, the marriage spent. of all men stands for all to see. I can't run no more with that lawless crowd, while the killers in high places say their prayers out loud. But they've summoned up a thundercloud. They're gonna hear from me. Ring the bell that's still to ring. That's how the light gets in. You can add up the parts, you won't have the sum. You can strike up the march, there is no drum. Every heart to love will come, but like a refugee. Ring the bell that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a
So the light was getting in.
I hope so. That's what it felt like. It felt amazing. So yeah, I just felt like I'd come home. Really, I felt like I'd found my people, if you like. I'll say a bit more about. There's some other lyrics in that I'll return to about forget your perfect offering and ring the bells that still can ring. Every heart to love must come, but like a refugee. I'll say a little bit more about that later. But, yeah, basically, I thought this is for me.
You jumped right in.
Well, I did sort of jumped in. Initially, I used to travel to Leeds, which was the closest centre. Well, it wasn't a centre, it was a house. It was a little house, basically, the front room, with one order member, Arya Mitra. And as far as I remember, one Mitra at the time, who described himself to me as a meditator, but not necessarily a Buddhist. So I don't know how he became a Mitra. So I used to go along to Leeds every week. But then one day, Aryamitra asked me, you don't fancy going to help build a retreat centre in Spain, do you? And I, yes, I do, actually, I do. I've been, as I said, I've been looking for something different to do. I love Hispanic culture. I love the landscapes. This sounded like just what I wanted to do. So,
spoke the lingo. You spoke the language.
I spoke the language. Yeah. So I was quite useful there.
Yeah.
So I gave him my notice, sold my house, gave away. I really thought of this as a going forth. I gave away my possessions. Some of my friends have still got my three piece suite. and off I went. And I spent basically a year at Guhiloca in two spells, initially building the retreat centre. And then after the retreat, I went back with a friend of mine, Terry Williams, who became Surya Prabha.
Yeah.
And we looked after the valley because there wasn't a community there. So a total of about a year. Mm. And I loved it. I loved it. I loved the outdoor life. I loved the beauty of the landscape, the elements again, the primitiveness. I met people like I didn't know existed. My first Mitra study, because I wasn't a Mitra when I went, was with Vasantara. I made a connection with Subhuti, who acted in a way as a sort of tantric guru for me, because he was constantly pushing me to do things that I thought, I can't do that. I travelled round with Subhuti and Bhante, translating for Bhante in public talks, which is probably the most stressful thing I've ever done in my life. Absolutely exhausting. He would say a sentence and I would have to translate it into Spanish. I'd got no Spanish Buddhist vocabulary. There wasn't any, really. What's mindfulness in Spanish? I don't know. And so this, I'd break out in a sweat. It's the concentration of switching from one language to another and talking to an audience. Mm. And he was a bit mischievous, so he would... I remember once he looked at me and he said, we have a saying in English, if wishes were horses, beggars would ride. And then he thought, how are you going to translate that? But one of the things it did for me, it did wonders for my public speaking, because my approach to public speaking before this has been, you don't make a fool of yourself. And I knew I was going to make a fool of myself. It really came to me, it's not about you, it's just try and get across what he's saying to the audience. So I would do things like saying, well, I don't know how to say that. Who knows how to say that in English? And people would chip in from the audience or something like that. So it was a real sort of, it actually broke things down. I'm told that, it was a few years ago now, they were still using the tape of one of these, the video of one of these, in the Valencia Buddhist Center.
Okay. Yeah.
But I felt really inadequate because I hadn't spoken Spanish in earnest for 15 years. Mm. And I didn't have any Buddhist vocabulary. Mm. But he, for some reason, he had native Spanish speakers, but what he said was, well, I know you'll translate what I say and not what you think I should say. Mm. So maybe that was the case.
Mm. Great training.
Yeah, it was
very
good.
And very early in your sort of...
Well, yes.
...in the FWBO, really.
Well, yes. Quite. So I hadn't been... I mean, I hadn't been involved that long.
Yeah.
A couple of years, maybe. Yeah. Maybe a year and a half. Mm. Maybe I'd have only been involved for a year when I went, something like that. And I wasn't a Mitra.
Mm.
So it was like we're a serious in the deep end. Probably the best... No, the best year of my life. Mm. The best year of my life. I loved it. And one of the things I remember is sleeping outdoors under the sky, and you'd know where, you know, you'd see the world, you'd see the constellations move around the North Star. You knew you were on a planet.
Mm.
You knew you were on a planet in space. You knew there was this immensity out there, and you were tiny. And you were very aware of the elements again. You could sit on the loo or crouch on the loo and see 30 miles to the next mountain range. Sorry to lower the tone, but yeah, very elemental, very elemental. I love the primitiveness and the elementalness. And this sense of, it really becomes clear to you that you are on a planet in space. Mm. So that brings me to my next track, which is Spinning Away by John Cale and Eno, I believe. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Shall we hear it, Paddy? Getting the atmosphere of the you as a tiny speck on this planet.
So some of the lyrics are, it's actually about somebody drawing as the sun goes down, all the constellations appear. He one of the lines I really like is, the great winds of the planet spiral in. Just that sense of the elements again and the vastness of the atmosphere. He says, the stars gradually appear, the constellations form. And he's just the wonder in his voice. He says, and the stars. Mm. It really brings it home. It really sort of evokes that sense to me of sleeping or being at night under a huge sky where there's no lights. It's just... well, quite astonishing. And Kukulcan then, even more than now, was extremely remote. You knew a car was coming because you could hear it 20 minutes before it arrived. Mm. Now there's a road part of the way up. But should we go with it?
Yeah. Well, I was wondering if we should come back to it or go with the flow of what we're doing.
Well, we maybe go with the flow, although it's very much about that. It sort of moves on from there, I suppose. So... yeah, I think we should have it, because I like it.
For Daniel, it's your desert island. Let's have the track.
As the great winds of the planet spiral in. Maybe we will skip it.
Maybe we'll skip that one. I don't know.
It's a shame because it's actually quite a nice track. But
we'll see if we can get it at the end. Well, that would be great.
You got the idea? Do you know what the problem is? Is it going to be like this with all of them?
Okay. We'll work it out, I'm sure.
Okay. So anyway, Kukulcan.
So you'd been thrown in the deep end with the order.
Yeah.
You were translating for Bante. You were doing... You were building Kukulcan with Subhuti, with Subhuti kind of directing you, as it
were. Well, Subhuti never directed us. Subhuti spent his time writing, and other people got on with directing us. We were building a retreat centre with £13,000. He bought a valley and several houses for £80,000 and had 13 left over. So we used to go scrounging around building sites for pallets. The pallet huts are still there. They don't. people don't live in them anymore. Yeah, it was an adventure. It was hard going. A lot of people hated it and left. But yeah, so I loved it, and I just knew that it was for me. I asked for ordination while I was there. I came back and looked for something to do involved in the movement, and I ended up having gone round several different places. I ended up working with Naga Bodhi for Windhorse Publications in Norwich.
And you were in Norwich then?
In Norwich, where I met Amoga Bangsa. I lived in a community in Norwich. Naga Bodhi lived in Pamaloka.
And this was the mid-80s?
We're talking 88, probably.
I think you had a reason to come back to Sheffield, didn't you?
Well, I'll tell you about that. So anyway, so Naga Bodhi wanted... So the editorial team was all over the place. And Naga Bodhi wanted to get a community house for the editorial team. And he couldn't afford it in Norwich. And I said, well, you'd be able to afford it in Sheffield. And there was an element of self-interest in this, because by this time I had already met Suryamati, and we were carrying on a long-distance relationship, so there was a slight element of self-interest in this. And also, I loved Sheffield. Norwich is nice enough, but it's surrounded by a food factory, and I just loved the countryside. And I was quite fond of Suryamati as well. So I said, well, it's got... you'd be able to afford it, and it's got lovely country nearby, very nearby. And so he came, and we had a look around. We looked at various houses, and he said, well, I mean, we'd probably come up, I don't know where we'd been, but anyway, he said, well, you know, we could afford it here. But what's this about lovely country? And we were getting an Indian takeaway. We were staying at Suryamati's, actually, and we were getting an Indian takeaway at the Bilash, which is by the Lescar pub.
Charavel Road.
And we said, well, how long is it going to be? And the guy said it'd be 20 minutes. And I said, I can take you and show you lovely country and get back by the time this curry is ready. And he said, if you can do that, we're moving to Sheffield. He did have an Alfa Romeo. But we zoomed out. We got a view down Derwent into the valley of the Derwent. We came back. And the curry was just ready.
Picked up your takeaway.
So he said, oh, right, we're moving to Sheffield.
I think I had a similar reason for moving to Sheffield.
Yeah.
Takeaway Stanley Judge in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So, yeah, so that's why we moved to Sheffield. So Windhorse bought Crooksmoor Road.
Yeah.
Community in Crooksmoor Road, which is the start of a long sort of...
Start
of
Triratna,
I suppose. People like Advayachitta and Punyamala moved up, I think, because of Naga Bodhi being here.
And you lived there with?
I lived there with Naga Bodhi, Shantavira, who did the proofreading, and Terry Williams, who I became a friend of in Spain, became Surya Prabha, and who... Bante Sangharakshita described us as the most unlikely friends he'd ever come across. But anyway, he moved up because I was up here. He wasn't that keen on it. It didn't have a good enough gay scene for him, I'm afraid. But
So you're working in Windhorse?
I was working in Windhorse, and I worked for Windhorse for a while. I wrote Introducing Buddhism, I helping to edit Golden Drum, and I wrote a bit for Golden Drum. But I...
I
slightly fell out with Naga Bodhi. I fell out about not getting ordained. Now, there's a lot of ego in this. I thought I was a star. I was living in a slum, working at a right livelihood for nothing. I'd written a best-selling book on Buddhism. I'd translated for Sangharakshita. I was writing articles for Golden Drum, and they wouldn't ordain me. I regarded this as a deserved promotion. And it wasn't happening. So I thought, well, I'm out of here. Not that I'm out of Tree Ratna, but that I'm out of the ordination process. I'm not doing that anymore.
Mm.
I can't do that.
Mm.
My life's just stalled. I'm going to make some money.
Mm.
So I did a couple of things after that. The first thing was leading, well, I went down and did some fundraising with a guy called Tim Lilly, who was the founder of Tree Ratna, not Tree Ratna, founder of Karuna style fundraising.
Mm.
And he asked me to come and lead campaigns in the north, in cities in the north.
Mm.
So this was pretty intense. I'd have to scope out the city, the demographics, get some premises, advertise for people, interview people. But then during the campaign, we would meet every day for 6 weeks. I taught them meditation. We would do communication exercises of various sorts to try and help them to get in touch with people. Tried to teach them a completely different approach to fundraising, which was, we don't want any money that people don't want to give us freely.
Mm.
That pressure, even persuasion, kills generosity.
Yeah. Mm.
And instead of which, generosity inspires generosity. So all we're doing is giving these people the opportunity to give, and your job is just to make a connection with them and give them that opportunity, and it's absolutely fine if they don't want to give. Just make it a pleasant experience for them, try and connect with them. So we did communication exercises, including the dread communication exercises, but others as well. A lot of just reporting in, because it's pretty much of an emotional roller coaster for a lot of people, so we try and sort of just help people stay in a positive state. I would go out with people in the evenings if they were having a hard time, if they needed a bit of advice or help. So it's very, very intense, actually, this. Also quite successful. So I did that in Sheffield, Manchester, Leeds, Bradford, and for my sins, Aberdeen, because somebody I was working with comes from Aberdeen. Aberdeen didn't work.
And that's the model that Karuna still use when they're doing the fundraising.
Well, I can't say whether Karuna do, but I think it should be.
Yeah, it would be.
And of course, it's the model we've tried to put in place here. Generosity inspires generosity. So I did that. And then I met a guy at a party who'd started an NGO working in West Africa. And he said to me, why don't you come? I talked about the style of fundraising. He said, well, that's what we want to do. That's what we want to do. Come and work for us. And we don't just have fundraisers. We work on projects as well. We work in the country as well. So I joined this NGO working in West Africa. I did do a lot of fundraising for them, but also went to Africa. And, it was very successful. So we ended up with a membership of we used to get about 100 grand in from members a year, which for an NGO like that is like a dream.
You could do a lot with 100
grand. Because NGOs work on hand-to-mouth grants, basically, small ones like that. So I thought, this is real right livelihood. This isn't selling wind chimes. This is real right livelihood. But actually, I became quite disillusioned with it. And it's a long story about why. One of the things I really realized is that the people we were working with were happier than the people in Sheffield. A serious question about why we were teaching them to be more like us. We was a development charity. Why were we teaching them to be more like us rather than getting them across to teach us to be more like them? I formed the conclusion among these very, very poor people that Britain, given the affluence of the place, but given the amount of negative mental states, dissatisfaction, greed, resentment, bitterness, that this was a country in the grip of a collective neurosis. And that the problems of the world were, I really wanted to make a difference to the world, but the problems of the world were not material. The problems of this world were spiritual. And Britain was suffering from them quite badly. And so it was never going to change the world by sort of trying to help people make a bit more money in Africa. especially at the cost of making them more like us. I really thought, yeah, it's the Dharma. The Dharma's the answer. The Dharma's the answer. It would solve the other problems as well. If everybody simply lived by the precepts, there'd be no wars, there'd be no, you know, it would be a different world. It would be a different world. I'll come back to that as well. So I thought, well, I really want to, I want to make a difference. I want to do it with the Dharma. And I came back into the ordination process with a completely different attitude that I want to give, not get. And with that different attitude, I was very, very quickly invited to be ordained by Subhuti. He invited me to be ordained in India.
So you dropped the idea of promotion, but you got
it was
the ordination.
It was a completely different approach to ordination, really. I want to do this because I want to join together with others to make a difference. And that relates back to Anthem, really. So Anthem describes, you know, ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. And I really came to the realization that if you wanted things to be perfect, you'd never make a difference. But the only way you were going to make a difference would be to join together with others and try and do something positive. And Sri Ratna was the best thing I'd come across. Try and do something positive with others. Forget perfect. Do what you can. Despite your imperfections, despite the imperfections of the other people, and despite the imperfections you can perhaps see in any organization you're going to be involved in, because no organization is perfect. If you try and be, if you want to be in your perfect ivory tower, you won't involve yourself unless it's absolutely as you want, then you'll never do anything. So that was quite a strong realization for me. I thought, I really want to work with these people. I want to work with, it's the best thing I've come across. It's the way I can make a difference. I want to be ordained. I want to be ordained to give, not to get. And, you know, it's amazing how these things communicate, because very, very quickly, Subhuti said, well, I'll ordain you in India. So I was ordained in India in 2000. At Bordaran, just outside Nagpur, in front of, they say, 10,000 people. I think in India, 10,000 just means quite a lot of people. In front of 10,000 people, it was a very moving experience. I've never eaten as many onion bhajis and pakoras in my life, I tell you, because everybody wanted to be photographed with you, and you had to eat their food as you went around. But Subhuti stood up and gave a barnstorming talk about, I think it was the 50th anniversary of Ambedkar, Dr. Ambedkar, delivering the Constitution to Congress. And Subhuti gave this barnstorming talk, which really made an impression on me, where he said, what Ambedkar said when he delivered the Constitution to Congress, he said, I've come up with the best constitution I can manage. But you must remember that in a country where people are operating on greed, hatred, and delusion, it will be a mess, whatever the constitution. And you must remember that if people are not operating on greed, hatred, and delusion, but kindness, generosity, and wisdom, it wouldn't matter what constitution you had, it would be a great country. So that really made quite a difference to me. It went along with some of the other things that I'd sort of realized when with work in the NGO where the solution lies. So that brings me to my next track. Let's
have the next track, shall we?
The next track is that's the next track. Have I missed one out?
It's Billy Bragg.
Yeah, the next track is Jerusalem, Blake's Jerusalem by Billy Bragg. It's half of it, because I've cut out the Christian bit at the front. And what you must remember about this is that Jerusalem represents the Pure Land. I'll say, come back to that a bit later.
Love of burning God.
my spirit, O clouds unfold. Bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from men to fight, nor shall my sword stay in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land.
Yeah, so Jerusalem in Blake's mind represented the pure land, the perfect place. But I would take, and that's what Billy Bragg's talking about building, but I would take a very different approach to building it to Billy Bragg, because I suggest that he's probably talking about building it by top-down politics. And I think we build pure lands from the bottom up by helping people come together on a dharmic basis. Very influenced by something that Bhante says in his seminar on the Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutta. And he talks about, he says, what a bodhisattva does is gather a community. That's a pure land is a, the Vimalakirti says a pure land is made of sentient beings. It's not a place, it's sentient beings. And Bhante says, well, what a bodhisattva does is create a pure land around them by gathering a community, particularly by various means, but by the practice of the Samprahavastus, which is the means of unification, the means of building a sangha, a community. And he says, well, we shouldn't think of ourselves as bodhisattvas. We shouldn't think of ourselves as bodhisattvas because that would be hubristic. But we should think of our centers as we should think of ourselves as coming together with others to create a bodhisattva where we engage in bodhisattva activity in the service of that bodhisattva.
So it's co-creation.
We co-create a pure land. You gather together with others and you attract others in, and thus you create a mini pure land. He talks about creating mini pure lands in the midst of the impure land. And that, I think, that's been my guiding myth about what we're doing at Sheffield Buddhist Centre. And I think it's become, as it were, the public myth of the people who work here, that we're building a pure land. We're gathering a community, building a pure land among us, attracting people in, particularly by the practice of the Samgrahavastis, which, of course, the first one is dana. So, hence, we have to have a dana economy. And that whole thing about generosity breeding generosity.
I think it links to something that Subhuti said to you when the advice that Subhuti said to you when you got ordained.
Does. Well, it wasn't when I got ordained. It was sometime after, I think. But yes, he said to me, my initial connection with Buddhism had very much about me and my meditation and my insight, me getting insight, etc. And Subhuti once said to me, well, before I was ordained, he once said to me, you've got a very strong Buddha refuge, a very strong Dharma refuge, but you don't have a Sangha refuge because you think you don't need them. Anyway, so there was still maybe I don't know whether there was some of that, but after I was ordained, he said to me, make your practice building Sangha. Now, he might have said that to me a million other times and it wouldn't have gone in, but sometimes something somebody says just goes like a depth charge. And it was like, boof, right, that's what I'll do. I'll make my practice building Sangha. So that's what I've tried to make my practice, building Sangha. And really that's what I've been trying to do for the last 20 years or so, 20-odd years, trying to keep that myth at the forefront of what we do here, because I think you need a myth, you need a mythic dimension to what you're doing in a centre. Otherwise, if there isn't that mythic dimension, it's tedium, low-paid tedium. But if you've got that myth, it's what it's your practice, it's what you do. And for ages, I just felt, this is what I do. And indeed, almost, that sounds superficial, this is what I was put here for. This is what my life has prepared me to do.
So in a sense, all of the lessons that you'd learned leading up to that point and the manifestation of the Sangha in Sheffield acquiring this building was all kind of coming to all,
well, yeah.
all coming together.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was Atra that got us the building, really. But but yeah, we came together. A group of people came together, and we really did something. And that was very much my myth, that, and others shared it, that we were doing this. It blossomed into this. And trying to keep that myth at the forefront of what we do, we're not a business. We don't think like a business. We're not an adult education centre. We don't think like an adult education centre. We're not a therapy centre. We don't think like a therapy centre. It's not a playground where order members do what they want. We're trying to... really have something in place that works. Just try to keep that there. I just find it amazing that this somewhat motley crew got together and did what we did, really. Because I think what we've created is quite good. Without wishing to blow my own trumpet.
Quite possibly the understatement of the evening. So you were really doing what you felt you were born to do.
That's what I felt. I mean, people sometimes ask me, doesn't that get in the way of your practice or that? And I always think, well, it is my practice.
It is your practice.
And you know, you work with others, and this is one of the things that Bantu says, you work with others, and your motives probably aren't absolutely pure. You've still got worldly winds operating, but you ring the bells that still can ring. You forget your perfect offering. You work together with others, and somehow something happens, and somehow maybe something bigger than any of you comes through. I mean, again, this might sound a bit superstitious, but I've really had the impression. Bantu says he didn't feel he founded Tree Ratan, he felt something founded it through him that it was seeking to manifest. Okay. And sometimes I've really felt like that about Sheffield Buddhist Centre, the luck we've had, that it wasn't, we didn't found it, something wanted to found it, and it used us to do it. Something wanted to manifest. It's the thing I'm happy about in my life. Is what we've done here, actually.
Yeah. I think
Moga Vangsa should feel really happy about it as well.
I think there's a sea of people out there who are all quite happy about that as well. I think we're coming to your last track,
aren't we? My last track is Gracias a la Vida by Joan Baez. Because I think after an initial piece of extremely bad luck, I've been very, very lucky. I think I was very lucky in my childhood in having the adventures I had, in being exposed to so many different cultures, which gives you a certain sort of perspective on culture. I think I was very lucky in the time that I lived. I was very lucky in the time that it was when I was in Mexico, actually. I think I was very, very lucky. We were a lucky generation. We had a time of unprecedented freedom.
Yeah.
We have less freedom now, I'm afraid. I could never have gone to Guajiloca for a year now. Couldn't do it. We haven't had any wars that we've had to fight in. We haven't been conscripted. We had tremendous freedom, really. And, so I think it's been a blessed time. I think we've been really lucky in Sheffield Buddhist Centre. I think the luck that's happened for this to be here, finding this place, you know, just so many things just went boop, 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 into place. Really lucky. Lucky in the group of people that mixed here. And I feel really lucky to have met Surimati as well, because she's a pretty wonderful woman, actually, to whom I owe a lot. Really lucky to have seen an advert in The Guardian It must have been the only time I ever put an advert in the first of columns of The Guardian, and that wasn't about Surya Matthew.
I was going to say, what? That wasn't Surya Matthew, that was Padma Loca,
that
just
was
to
Padma
make
Loca.
It clear.
I met Surya Matthew through a friend of mine who got into the Dharma through me, because when I went off to Guhyaloka, we worked together, and he said, I wish I'd got the bottle to do that. And anyway, he subsequently became an order member. That's Shantipala. And Surya Matthi was lodging with Shantipala while she was buying his house. And that's when I met Surya. So I was very lucky to meet her as well. Very lucky my friends, some of whom are here. Just feel really blessed, actually. So gracias a la vida.
Gracias a la vida. Let's have it.
Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me dio dos luceros que cuando los abro perfecto distingo lo negro del blanco y en el alto cielo su fondo estrellado y en las multitudes al hombre que yo amo. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado el sonido y el abecedario con él las palabras que pienso y declaro, madre, amigo, hermano y luz alumbrando la ruta del alma del que estoy amando. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado el oído y en todo su ancho traba noche y día, grillos y canarios, martillos, turbinas, ladridos, chubascos y la voz tan tierna de mi bien amado. Montañas y llanos y la casa tuya, tu calle y tu patio. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, me ha dado la risa y me ha dado el llanto, así yo distingo dicha de quebranto, materiales que forman mi canto y el canto de ustedes que es mi propio canto. Gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto.
So, yeah, gracias a la vida que me ha dado tanto, given me so much. Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful music. Thank you. Wow, that's been amazing, hearing all the music, Vidanya, and thank you for sharing your life
with
us.
Thanks for doing it. Thanks for doing this. It's a great series. Yeah. Great idea. Thank you.
I think it's really lovely for the rest of us to, for us to hear what about the history of the place, you know, and how, and it's just fascinating as well, how, what everything that comes, all the different conditions that come together to make the community, to make the Sangha. Thank you. But it's come to the point where I'm going to cast you away.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to give you Bhante's memoirs.
Right.
Which will keep you busy for a bit.
Yeah.
You can have the Dhammapada as
you.
Well.
Thank you.
So you've got some Dharma. I did ask you, you're going to get your choice of a book as well. So you can have all these books, but... And I know you wanted T.S. Eliot.
Yeah, well, I wanted the complete works of T.S. Eliot.
I will make sure he gets the complete
including
works.
Including the four quartets, which aren't in that, because... well, the four quartets are amazing, and it keep me busy for quite a long time trying to figure out what on earth he's talking about. I think T.S. Eliot's my favourite poet. He's definitely got a spiritual dimension. He was a Christian, but a lot of what he says is very resonant of Buddhism. I really love his poetry, and it couldn't be a novel. It would have to be, you know, and it's a, the complete works of T.S. Eliot is big.
It's going to keep you
so
busy.
So it's going to keep me going, yeah.
Yeah.
There's all the plays as well, which nobody ever reads, but I'm sure they're pretty useful as well. So, yeah, the complete works of T.S. Eliot, if I may.
I will make sure that they're on the shipwreck so that you can rescue them.
I could probably row ashore on it.
You might be able to. Now, you're allowed to take a luxury. You've asked for a luxury. I'm not sure it counts as a luxury, but I'm going to give it to you.
Well, you see, I want the luxury of eating on this desert.
Well, that's okay, yeah.
And while I do have a history of fishing, I could perhaps catch fish if I would allow myself to. But one thing there always is on desert islands is coconut trees. Yeah. Because coconuts wash around in the sea, and that's how they get to various places. So there's always coconut. And the reason they can wash around in the sea is because they're about that big, and they've got about that much...
husk.
Really tough husk. They're not like the ones you get in the fairground. They've got this really tough fibrous, which has all been cut off. And there's only two things in the world that can get into a coconut. And one is a particularly huge mutant crab that lives on one Pacific island. And the other is a human being with a machete. So I want a machete. That's my luxury. I can also build a shelter with it.
So that's your luxury, which seems a bit practical for me, but I will give it to you so that you can have some good cuisine.
Thank you.
So that
I can
will
eat
be your
coconuts
luxury.
Anyway.
Coconuts. Yeah. You can eat coconuts, yeah. And, well, this comes back nicely to the Brian Eno, John Cale track, if we can, because I think that's the one that you're going to save.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit that if I was actually trying to save a track, it probably wouldn't be that, but I wouldn't have chosen these tracks to take with me anyway. I mean, I would have chosen some dance music and something classical, but given that I've got to choose it from this lot, I'll have John Cale and Spinning Away if we can play it. And, of course, the stars will be there circling around on my desert island with no lights. I'll be very aware of being on a planet.
I have to say, we've had a dialogue during this whole process of eight tracks are just not enough. So I think that's what you're referencing, isn't it?
I think if you're 74 years old, you should get more than eight tracks. I lived
agree.
In four different countries by the time I was 14. I could have had a track from all of them.
I totally agree, but the format is eight tracks. And I'm afraid Punyamala pushed it and got an extra one. But
oh, well, you didn't tell me that.
Let's have Spinning Away again, shall we? Paddy. Thank you everyone for coming. Thank you for Anna and the team, Lila Matti, I can't remember who cooked, everyone who cooked. It was an amazing meal. Kamajit, Shabam, Vidya, great meal. Thank you so much. And thank you so much to Paddy for doing the tech brilliantly. Thank you. And Pranya Hridaya for backup on tech. That's great. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you for doing it.
Cheers.